Forbes senior editor David Ewald grew up playing Dungeons & Dragons, and now he tells its fascinating story and of Dice and Men, the story of Dungeons & Dragons and the people who play it. It's The Lord of the Rings meets Moneyball in a unique and authoritative book on Dungeons & Dragons, from the game's origins through its rise to cultural prominence and its ripple effect on popular culture today. It's a pleasure to welcome David Ewald to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Give us an idea of what led you to write this book and to look at the phenomenon that has been around for a long time, that is Dungeons & Dragons.
Well, I had played Dungeons & Dragons a lot when I was a kid. You know, like a lot of people my age, the game was very big in the late 70s and throughout the 80s. And I played it a lot in elementary school, junior high, and high school. I didn't play for years, but then when I got into journalism, I eventually became a technology reporter for Forbes and started writing about the video game business. And just as part of due diligence, when I started that new beat, when I would meet game designers and executives in the game business, I would ask them, so what made you want to make games for a living? And over again, the story I heard from them was, oh, I played a lot of Dungeons and Dragons when I was a kid. So it made me realize that there was something more to this game than just being a childhood pastime, that it was really an incredibly influential game, both on American business, but on modern pop culture and on all the people who played it.
Give us an idea of how it rose to prominence. It was released in 1974, and it took a while for it to really take off.
It did. It took a couple years after the game first came out to even make progress among the gaming community, the people who were really into war games, which were the predecessor to Dungeons and Dragons. But by 1979, the game was popular among war gamers and among college students who were really into J.R.R. Tolkien, who was also big there in the late 70s. And something happened to push the game out to the mainstream, which was a young student, a young genius, a kid who had graduated from high school early and then went to college early, had gone off to college and disappeared. When he went missing from his dorm room, the police and his parents went to find out, you know, to search his room and figure out what happened. And all they found were these weird rule books with pictures of dragons on them and with lists of spells. They had no idea what they were because they were Dungeons and Dragons handbooks, of course. And the game was very new and very few people had heard of it. But the police assumed, oh, this is some sort of weird spell book. This kid is obviously under the effect of some strange satanic game, and this is why he's gone missing. The truth was the kid, you know, not surprising for a young genius, was alienated from other students. He was suffering through a bout of depression, and he had run away. But that idea that the game was satanic and dangerous got out into the media and became a national news story. And press, that was certainly the case for Dungeons and Dragons. And that news story, really, the game exploded after that. And within a few months and within the end of the year, everyone was playing it. And within the next couple of years, it was the hottest game in the entire country.
I remember that point and growing up and saying, oh, this is a cool game. Everybody's talking about it. And then getting a copy for the holidays and looking at it. I swear to you, David, I tried, but I just don't. I didn't get it then. And I don't quite get it now of what it is, because it was a book and some dice and that was it, and a lot of imagination. And then I felt stupid that I couldn't figure it out.
It's not an uncommon reaction to people who just pick up the books. I describe the game to people as a kind of collaborative storytelling. It's not like a game like Monopoly where you have a board and where it's very simple and you're just following directions. Really what you're meant to be doing is sitting down at a table with six or seven other people, and you're directed through an adventure where you're playing one of the heroes. So it's very hard to sort of wrap your head around that if you're only just reading the books. The best way to get into the game is to meet people who've been playing the game for a while, who know how to do it, and to sort of watch them and see, oh, okay, I get it now. You know, because it's that sort of participatory social event, just reading the books, they're very dense and it can be hard to understand.
The subtitle of your book is The Story of Dungeons and Dragons and the People Who Play It. That aspect was important for you, to look at the people who play this game.
Yeah, I mean, it's because I had a history with it. You know, it was very important to me when I was a kid, because it's a social game, and it's how I bonded with my friends. I mean, the guys who I hung out with most of the time were also the guys that were my D&D friends, were the guys I played role-playing games with. And it's an important game for lots of people all over the world. And that's, you know, why I wanted to make this more than just a history of the game and just sort of where it came from, but also look at it as a cultural force, as a thing that helps people make friends, as a thing that gives people a kind of escape from their everyday mundane lives. It's valuable to people, not just as a social tool, but as a, you know, as a psychological tool. It really has great emotional benefits for the people who play it.
Where does it rank in popularity today?
Well, the game now remains sort of a niche hobby. Gaming as a hobby overall is bigger than it's ever been. Everybody plays video games of some sort now, even if it's just you know, playing something small on their phone when they're waiting in a line. D&D within that category is pretty small. It's hard to say how many people are playing it because lots of people, you know, bought the rules 40 years ago and are still using those rules and haven't bought anything since. But I think it's also, you know, facing a revival, especially because there's so many people who play video games now. Trying something like Dungeons and Dragons doesn't seem as strange as it used to be. So the game it has surged in popularity in the last couple of years, and there's a new rule set coming out next year, which I think is going to help bring it back to the mainstream.
Who are the authors? Who has the rights? Who ultimately comes up with this stuff that's official?
Well, the current publisher of Dungeons & Dragons is a company called Wizards of the Coast. They're based in the suburbs of Seattle, Washington. Wizards of the Coast is actually owned now by Hasbro. So it's the, you know, one of the biggest toy companies in the world. It gives you an idea of just how valuable this game and this brand is.
How long has Hasbro owned it?
Hasbro brought it about a decade ago. Wizards of the Coast has owned it since the mid-90s. Once Hasbro bought the game, it kind of laid fallow for a few years, but Hasbro has spent the last decade since they bought it pulling together all the rights. You know, they bought the rights to the game, but for a long time, the rights to the video game and the rights to D&D-themed movies and TV shows, those were all owned by other people. And Hasbro spent a lot of time gathering up the entire D&D brand. And now that they've got them all, you can expect Hasbro to be investing a lot of money back into the Dungeons & Dragons brand in the next couple of years.
Is there a clear creation story?
Well, these games came out of war games, the kind of games where you might have infantrymen and cannon on a table and you're recreating a historical battle from the Civil War, from the Napoleonic Wars. And what happened in the early 1970s is that the guys who enjoyed playing those war games wanted to experiment. They decided to play around with the rules. And the key innovation was somebody said, well, why do I have to play an entire army or push around a figure that represents a battalion of soldiers? Why can't we just play a single soldier, play some single hero in an adventure? And that quickly evolved into playing fantasy heroes. And Lord of the Rings was very popular at the time. And so it became a question of, oh, we're going to play wizards and warriors in a fantasy adventure. The two guys who really authored Dungeons & Dragons were Gary Gygax and David Arneson. It was their names who were on the first publication of the rules. And what they did was they codified this idea of we're going to have a story that we tell together. And they made a set of rules to sort of separate it from just simple make-believe. It's imagination and it's creativity, but there are rules quantifying how we do it. And, you know, if you're going to try to kill a monster or knock down a door, you're going to roll a die and check a table to see if that works. And that's what they came up with, is a system to have this sort of adventure in your heads with other people.
And what about luck? Does luck play a role?
Luck is a definite factor. The dice in the game work as part of that. You roll dice when you're going to try to achieve something, in part because that gives you a factor of luck. You know, you can always roll very poorly. You roll a low number and you're not going to be able to hit that monster. It's also a big factor. You know, when you have your character, you start the game by rolling some dice to see how strong you are, how smart you are. And if luck is against you, you could very well end up with a weak hero. You know, you might have a fighter who can barely lift his sword. And so that element of luck can really change the game and make it play out in interesting ways.
The one thing that surprised me in the book is how this really played out worldwide. This was the game is and was very popular worldwide.
Yeah, it really exploded in the late 70s and early 80s. And I think it's because you know, fantasy is something we can all relate to. There's a lot of archetypes in this game that are universal to the human experience. It's the idea of the epic hero. And that's something that people understand all over the world. The game was very quickly translated into other languages. It crossed Europe first, but it was also very big in Asia and in South America. And to this day, if you go to a convention or you go to places where D&D fans gather, you see people from all over the world.
Are we as patient as we were in the 1970s and 1980s to play a game that can go on for a long time?
It's interesting. I think in one way, the fact that we are less patient and that we're more focused on instant gratification has pushed a lot of players into doing things like video games, where they can just turn it on and play for 5 minutes and then do something different. But at the same time, the revival of Dungeons & Dragons that we're seeing right now, I think, is coming out of the same experience, because we live in such a fast-paced, short attention span world, people are valuing more, oh, I get to sit down for 3-4 hours with the same group of friends. We're going to carve a section out of our schedule. We're going to dedicate ourselves to this experience to a couple hours, because it's so much more valuable when you finally find the time to do that. And I think people are responding to the game now precisely because it does require a longer set of attention and time, and you have to make room for it in your schedule, and that means something to people, and they get more out of it that way.
You write quite extensively about the cultural impact, which is really prominent.
Yes, the game, particularly because it was so big in the 80s, and everybody who was growing up at the time, you know, played it at least once or heard of it, all these people now who are making content, who are making movies or films or writing books, look back and say, oh, that's where I first learned how to tell a story. That's what inspired me to be creative and to make things up. I mean, it's everyone from the director of the Iron Man films, Jon Favreau. He says that he was a dungeon master. He played D&D when he was a kid, and that's really what taught him how to hold an audience and how to keep people's attention. There's also lots of novelists and people who make TV shows like Lost, and those are all guys who say they got their start at the D&D table.
And that role of fantasy, I guess I find interesting, of which gets down to that core of at a point in our life and a point in time where we want to be someone else, that we can take on a role of something or someone else.
It's there's something very special and atavistic about this game. Really what you're doing is you're creating a fantasy character. You're creating a wizard or a barbarian or a knight. But then you're sort of inhabiting that character. You're giving them motivation. You're giving them emotion. And you're pretending for a while that you are that person. And so when you play the game, you have a much more visceral experience. It's not like when you're playing a video game and you see the character on the screen and there's a sort of separation between you and that character. Or when you're playing a board game and it's just sort of this, you know, it's the battleship or a thimble on a Monopoly board where there's no relationship between you and that piece. In D&D, you're becoming the character in a very real way. And so it becomes personal, and it's much more exciting. You get more out of it. And the thrill of the game is much stronger because you have that relationship. And you are sort of projecting yourself into the character.
It says on the front of the book, David Ewald, level 15 cleric. What does that mean?
Well, a cleric is one of the different classes in the game, because it is sort of hewing to these fantasy archetypes. You can be a wizard, you can be a fighter, you can be a thief. And one of the character classes is cleric. A cleric is kind of a magician. They are, sort of a Gandalf-y character that they can cast spells. But a cleric specifically casts spells to help the other players. They're focused on healing spells. So if your fighter runs in to fight a monster and gets injured, he can come back to the cleric, and the cleric can cast a spell and stitch up his wounds and make him feel better.
And he writes for Forbes magazine as well, and the new book is Of Dice and Men, the story of Dungeons and Dragons and the people who play it. It is published by Scribner. David Ewald, I thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, Of Dice and Men, the story of Dungeons and Dragons and the people who play it. The book is published by Scribner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.